This episode of Austinpreneur is brought to you by Advanced Technology International. To remain a global leader in emerging technologies and markets, the U.S. must bring together the best and brightest. At Advanced Technology International, this has been the core of their business for 25 years. For government agencies, ATI accelerates and de-risks the process of working with innovators and entrepreneurs across the country. For industry and academia, they simplify access to government funding to solve national security problems. A catalyst for innovation, ATI is helping our nation deliver transformative technologies of the future today. Start accelerating your impact and head over to www.ati.org. That's ati.org. Now let's start the show. Welcome, everyone, to the Austinpreneur Podcast, where we discuss innovation and entrepreneurship in Texas. We're recording live here at Capital Factory during Fed Supernova 2024. Our guest for this episode is Charlie Burgoyne, who's the CEO of Valkyrie, as well as a mentor at Capital Factory for almost a decade now. I remember Charlie was one of the few folks with significant DoD-funded experience before Army Futures Command came to Austin and before Capital Factory. Most of us were thinking about any of this stuff we're talking about here at Fed Supernova, and so I'm excited to have him on the show for that reason. On top of his role at Valkyrie, Charlie advises U.S. Central Command on AI and previously did the same for SOCOM. And recently, Valkyrie launched a product company, Andromeda, on the heels of a $4.5 million pre-seed funding round that included a bit from us here at Capital Factory. So excited to have you in the portfolio and excited to welcome you to the show, Charlie. Welcome to Austinpreneur, our show about the stories that made Austin, Texas, a global hub for startups. The show is produced by Capital Factory and hosted by me, Nick Spiller. As a reminder, by joining Capital Factory, you can plug into the ecosystem where the stories on the show were set. Learn more about us at capitalfactory.com. I came over to the office and I hung out with you and Drishti and Liz. Liz is a great champion of Capital Factory, taught me a bit when I started here. But before that, I think the last time I remember engaging with you in person was on the 77th floor of the Austonian Club, of the Austonian. And you were launching a race team.
Yeah.
Valkyrie Racing.
2019.
That was the same year we launched our Center for Defense Innovation. Funny enough, that'd be a fun place to start. What's the update on Valkyrie Racing?
Yeah. We dug into that operation. It's a very unique approach we took on for racing. We were convinced that there were opportunities in there for developing relationships with qualified stakeholders and building out the brand more effectively. And one of our problems was that all these projects that we had been doing up to that point were super clandestine, super, super secretive things that we were doing on the corporate side, some government stuff. And so we wanted something we could talk about loudly. And so we started a program designed to have a really intimate relationship with racing to not only grow the business, but also develop technologies that were innovative, really cool. And we've taken a couple of years to identify the right orchestration. This year is definitely the model we're going to be pursuing kind of at infinitum. We're really excited about it. We have four cars that race in 8 or 9 places stateside and 7 or so countries across the world with our partner United Autosports. So we develop all the technological capabilities for them around pit stops, working on car setup now, and basic strategy components that are integral to their operation.
Yeah, as you were working on these advanced projects, but you couldn't talk about them. You couldn't use them to build a brand as much as you may. People would be interested in that. And so the racing team was a way to showcase your skills in a publicly demonstrable fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, ranged from all sorts of different types of applications. And we were with lots of different series. I mean, we did a project with Formula One. We did a project with Le Mans prototypes, sports cars stateside, Indy cars. Lots of different things. One year we had 13 cars that were part of the program, just too much to manage. So we're down to 1 team, 4 cars that they operate. It's great.
Do you ever get to drive?
I do. Awesome. In fact, the car that we got our first podium in, Formula 4 car back in 2019, is at my house, and I'm working on it.
Taking it out on the weekends? Street legal?
Not ready yet for that, but we'll get there when I...
Is that the one that was outside the Austonian at that party?
That's the same one.
Yeah, the same one. I remember hanging out there, and yeah, not every day you see a car like that parked outside.
Oh, yeah, Formula 4, open wheel, very scary. It's a scary, scary thing to ride around.
It is. Unfortunately, I don't know if it'll be the scariest thing we talk about in this podcast episode.
I certainly hope not. Yeah.
But that was a great, great fun way to start. And I certainly seems like a fun way to drive company culture and get out there and do some cool stuff. And even for, I think, a lot of companies and founders that, even if it's not top secret, some stuff you just can't like go build a big brand around, you know, whether these deep plumbing of the internet or the infrastructure stuff, it's hard to get fun. So I thought that was such a creative out of the box way that I hadn't seen.
It was a really insane idea. A lot of people actually thought it was a terrible idea. And I think on paper, in a lot of ways, it could have been. But we're Valkyrie, the core of the operations, fully bootstrapped, fully independent organization. So we have a lot of autonomy. I don't have a governing board. I don't have a board of advisors. And it gives us the ability to operate with, you know, quite a bit of flexibility. And it was required of the racing operation. It was probably 2 years before we got really, really valuable outputs from that. Now it's an integral part of our pipeline.
Nice. Awesome. Well, glad to hear that's still going and thriving. So moving into more the topic of this session around misinformation and AI in the battlefield. But I noticed you have a quote I found, I think it was in one of your profiles. It says, that which was once thought to be probabilistic will be understood as deterministic. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that there's a dogma for young scientists, mathematicians, statisticians in particular, to reject the possibility of different events being causally related to each other in favor of a correlation. So good statistics courses, you really encourage you to reject causality at all points.
Right, correlation doesn't mean causation. Everyone's heard that in class.
And I actually found that to be pretty ignorant, especially in an age where the proliferation of instrumented data is all over the place. In other words, almost everything you do is captured, collated, quantified, measured, compressed, distributed, democratized. And so we are finding that lots of things are super causally related to each other. A good chunk of Valkyrie's revenue comes from us identifying these causal inferences that canonical statistics would tell us to reject. And so I think one of the reasons that's such a central tenet for Valkyrie is because it's so antithetical to the way most statisticians approach problems. But it's very in line with the way econometricians approach problems. So I think of like John Nash and the equilibrium theorem, a lot of the game theory folks and the guys who are focused on stochastic mechanics, those guys actually appreciate that a lot more than the traditional folks who are entering into this applied science field of machine learning and AI. And that's important for us. So like we insist on that. As a tangible example, we think a lot about commodity trading and things like saffron may not be a commodity that has active traders in 10 years. Saffron's a very limited, you know,
spice,
not doesn't go a lot of places. But right now, because the market is relatively inefficient in understanding where those spices go, there's a bit of arbitrage to be had for people to bet on the value of that. The reality is that all of the sources of saffron, where saffron could go, could be articulated in theory. So the arbitrage, the inefficiency of that particular market could collapse and people wouldn't trade on it anymore. We've been using that example in the lab for years and years and years as kind of a thought experiment to where things could be going. But we see this actively, lots of different domains, especially in information warfare.
Okay, so shifting to the DoD side, you're an advisor for U.S. Central Command. For our listeners, anyone in the room doesn't know what Central Command is. Let's start there. What is that? And then what is your role as a tech advisor there?
Yeah, so it's a combatant command. It's one of the areas where we have armed forces serving. And basically, this covers Turkey, more or less, all the way down to Pakistan and everything north of Africa and south of Russia. So you can more or less, the way you can think about it. So my responsibility is to serve General Kirilla and his team to identify different ways in which techniques and applied sciences can support the warfighter. My responsibility is, with some degree of periodicity, go downrange with them, observe operations, be super engaged, come back and write white papers about what we can do.
So I went last May to a number of countries that you would expect. And then I have another trip coming up in February, it looks like.
Yeah. And what were, are there a few observations you can share with us from that trip?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I can't share all the locations I was in, but I was into Crete and in Iraq. And one of the bases we were staying at, we were actively talking about counter UAS. And this is a big problem for all of the COCOMs, but particularly Central Command. I should also caveat here, I do not speak on behalf of DoD for any of these conversations today.
Yeah, yeah.
Fully my independent third-party observation. But it's on top of mind for everybody. Countering drones. And super sadly, the base I was staying at during that trip, about 10 days later, was actually attacked with drones based from a near peer in the region. Killed a number of contractors and I think injured one service. So it's a real problem. And it's what they're...
And these are off the shelf drones or like what are you...
They're state-based and can't probably dive into too much detail about the drones themselves, but these are drones that are designed, built by our near peers. Not little DJI Mavics with grenades.
Yes.
I mean, that's EUCOM, the European Command. That's all over in Ukraine right now.
Ukraine. Yeah. That's where I've heard that is off-the-shelf drones that are just equipped with a grenade or something.
That's absolutely right. And that actually is a part of what's going on in Israel as well. October 7th was heavily dependent on effective DJI-based drone.
Yeah, it seems there's a pivot in aerospace and that there was this for a long time. It was about propulsion, go faster, go harder. And now there's this other issue of more, you know, smaller, faster, distributed, lightweight stuff with drones and other, just I would say, like IoT devices that are in the field now.
I can't attribute this directly to General Carrillo, but it's definitely become inculcated within the command that we're targeting solutions that cost a tenth of what we're deterring costs to create, right? So if it costs them $100 to create a drone, we want to create a $10 way of disrupting that.
Right.
And I think that framing is really effective. You know, obviously they want 100 times that. But that framing is really, really helpful for the command, especially the task forces that are responsible for R&D.
Right. It's almost like the unit economics in a way. For some short period of time, sustain expensive solutions. But if we really need to sustain this for a while, it needs to be economic.
Totally.
Yeah. Totally. So I understand you know a lot about misinformation. I think the general public now knows a little bit about it in general, but let's dive into that topic and then we'll talk about the role of accountable AI. But first, when you're thinking about misinformation, disinformation, what is that? What are the risks? And then we can unpack it from there.
Yeah, I might start with a tangible example and back into these definitions because the vernacular is really crowded. Like there's a lot of semantic conflation around all these terms. So the current role I have with CENTCOM, I had the same role with SOCOM back in 2019, 2020. And as part of that role, I was sent into Indo-PACOM. During that time, I observed lots of different activities, Operation Cobra Gold, some kinetic stuff. But then what I actually was really remarking on it was how our warfighters who were focused on information warfare were struggling. They were actually wildly under-equipped. And the adversary was extremely well refined. Kind of highlighted in one specific use case, I was there not that long after the kids in Thailand were stuck in the cave.
Yep.
And what actually happened behind the scenes is actually fascinating. SOF guys, the Special Operation Forces guys, came through and did a lot to help empower the Thai to be able to get these kids out, gave them all sorts of supplies and support. And they did it very quietly. And that's really that's a major part of the MO of soft culture is to be really quiet, resolve. It's kind of that Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly, carry a big stick kind of mentality. And so the juxtaposition between that and what the Chinese did, the Chinese came in, they didn't do anything to help the kids, came with bags of cash to give to the families of the kids, and then paid to have billboards put up where they took pictures with these kids. And these billboards said, look at what we did. We got the kids out. Isn't it great to be close to China, right? And so we didn't have a response to that because that's really antithetical to how we operate. And so I started tracking the perception of the relationship between the United States and Thailand, technically our oldest ally, oddly enough. How has that relationship shifted over this period of time with the proliferation of information and the way people think about themselves and how that identity has really shifted? It's become this more amorphous, algorithmically driven state. What does that actually look like? So I wrote this white paper saying, sir, we got to track this. Back to General Tony Thomas, I said, so we got to track this. And in order to track this, I think we could use graph theory to be an integral part of solving this problem. And that paper got refined by our team that's like wildly better at science than I am. And the paper basically said, you know, there are these things called knowledge graphs. Technology is not quite there for them to be deployed at scale, but they're going to be really powerful when they are. We could probably pair them with these things called multimodal transformers, or maybe LLM is what the name was going to be that catches on, you know, 4 months out from a publication from Stanford. If you combine these two things, you may have a line of sight to be able to track perturbations in information warfare. How are we understanding where China is having a real big influence for the proliferation of neo-Marxism in that command? How are we thinking about how radical jihadism emanating out of Eastern Syria proliferates throughout the command? How do we think about how cronyism, ostensibly crony capitalism, is expanding within Southern Command and creating really destabilizing events for our resources, right? Those are all questions that fundamentally, that's actually the base topology for all warfare. Like that's actually what people care about at their core. It's not whether or not a gun is in a car or a gun's not in a car. It's whether or not somebody's likely to buy a gun or raise a flag, right? And so the big mind shift that I'm aggressively advocating for across all the COCOMs and candidly across the IC as well is we need to embrace the fact that the technology is now at the point where we can fully deploy capabilities where the base structure is the nature of influence and information, and that we can build on top of that these kinetic capabilities for Central Command and these space-based capabilities and cyber capabilities for Space Force. You go on and on and on about all the relevant domains within each of the commands.
Right. And none of that works without good information, good data. And in fact, it can be very dangerous if you don't have good information.
100%. In fact, just recently, I can't share too many details, but a certain militant group in the area I serve in threatened a young school, a school full of young kids. They cleared out the kids, our allies in the region, they cleared out the kids. And then that adversary actually created misinformation intentionally, saying that the school was clear for kids to go back in. And then they launched rockets in the area. Now, nobody was hurt, thank God. But we're now seeing a conjunction between information warfare and more traditional kinetic operations really seamlessly, and it's terrifying. Ukraine's got great examples too. 1,200 to 1,400 attacks from the Russians all around propaganda and information daily.
It's wild for me to think how social media was received by society when it first came out. And I remember 13, 14 years old, my parents just like, what a waste of time. You know, kind of same thing on video games, different podcast. But a lot of people would look at it as like a harmless, whatever, internet, app, whatever. And it turns out it's a crazy refined platform for what you're talking about. And something that's been going on with different countries and actors. There's been propaganda for a long, long time, but this was the weapon that made it proliferate to magnitudes more than I think you ever could, dropping pamphlets out of an airplane or however else they used to do it with billboards and stuff. I mean, it's just blows my mind.
Yeah, and it's kind of a two-front problem, because while we are consuming all of these medium in a way for our actual worldview to shift, we also have all these medium that are impacting our self-view. And one of the revelations that are coming out across a couple of different domains, like psychologists are thinking about this a lot. Obviously, those who are concerned with ethical AI, accountable AI are thinking about this a lot. It's a realization that a human being is predominantly defined based off of their relationships. It's actually very, very hard for human beings to operate in isolation. We're tribal critters. We're pack animals. And that has actually super deep existential psychological implications for us. I'm not really an automaton. I'm really a husband. I'm really a father. I'm really a colleague at work. I'm a friend. I'm all of these things. I use all of these conjunction relationship-based terms to define myself. And the subtlety of that is that at its core, when I start having those relationships replaced with synthetic media that are designed for engagement, not for authenticity, bad stuff starts to happen. And we're already seeing testaments to that. I'm on my HOA board. I really know like 4 people in my neighborhood, and there's like 150 people in my HOA. My parents knew most of their neighbors. My grandparents knew all of their neighbors, right? Somebody's kid gets sick, breaks their leg, whatever. There's a whole meal train that pops up tomorrow. I couldn't tell you the name of some of the kids in my neighborhood. same, you can talk about other forms of tribalism, religion, organization of sub-tribal entities. These are all entities that are collapsing right in front of us in favor of the synthetic media. And so when you have somebody who goes from being defined by their relationship with their friends, their neighbors, their family, which they don't even live in the same city with anymore, they're waiting to start their own until very, very late in life, you have this atomization of the identity itself that has used digital medium to supplant that. And that's actually really terrifying. That's terrifying, not only because all these medium are not orchestrated for your health, they're orchestrated for your engagement. It undermines your own identity sense and makes you extremely malleable. Explains things like something like 62% of all undergrads in Ivy League schools are medicated for some form of depression currently. It explains how 12% of folks who register as Democrats who are under the age of 35 are proud to be American and would put up resistance if there was an incursion from a foreign state. I'm not just picking on Democrats. There are all sorts of issues on both sides of the equation that I could go into. But all of these senses of identity, of self, are going through this major compromised state, this evolution, and all these tools that we're developing are exacerbating that problem.
There's been a filter put in between all of us.
Totally.
Right? And if you don't know what to believe, you don't know what to trust. If you don't trust, you know, what can you get done?
Well, think about it this way. If you and I were having just a conversation, there's a good chance I change my perspective about something that's deep. I learned something more about you. I learned to care about you and your family. You know, you have a beautiful baby. It's about the same age as my new nephew. So shout out to Kofels. I learn all these things I can actually write. But that's the way organic relationships should operate. If instead my goal was to say whatever it took to keep you in this room, very, very different things happen to your psyche. And that's not a bad analog to what's going on right now in these digital forums.
Yeah, I've noticed this with podcasting. I sit down one-on-one with someone and I will say the same, all three scenarios, saying the same thing. We'll pick up some of it. They'll answer, they'll respond. But I'll notice I come back in a month or two and it wasn't comprehended, you know, or at least all it's like, oh, I don't really know what you're doing. I don't really know what Capital Factory is, even though I've told you, it's kind of a common one. And then setting like this here, we have an audience listening. I think you'll pick up a little more that way. But people that listen to my podcast, they come up after they listen to the podcast, they get it and they ask like the deepest questions. And it's, I don't know, there's something about how we value the record of someone versus actually like what someone is directly. It's just stood out to me through this. And
you're hitting on a point that's very related and also super scary also, which is right as these identities are getting compromised by these digital engagement mediums, our own ability to synthesize complexity has been greatly diminished. I'm a physicist. My grandfather was a physicist. By all measures, he was no smarter than I am. I'm no smarter than he was. We went to the same, similar schools. Not the same school, but similar schools. On his deathbed, the dude could derive Maxwell's equations and Schrodinger's equations on his own, no problem, right? Build a transistor radio. I'm like 10 years out of grad school and I can't do those things. Right? Now, maybe you just comment, you had a lot of other things in your mind or like you weren't that great of a physicist, but I actually think it's a pretty fair analogy. And I really have been soul searching why. Why is that? The reality is my grandfather went through this process where when he had to learn about Maxwell's equations, it was a 14-step process across three levels of the library. 14 different books had to be pulled out, on and on and on. And that synthesis is just fundamentally different than what I went through. I admittedly jammed for midterms and like Wikipedia got me through StatMech. Yes. Yeah. But I depended on those tools. And I don't think we've realized that the information age may actually be undermining our ability to reconcile the information through knowledge. Because still, when you form a memory, when you're twisting those proteins to create these storage components, all those twists are still a biomechanical process. They have to have some sort of sensory-based stimulation to be able to occur.
For every action, there's a reaction.
One, it's just time dependent.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You're going to run an experiment with, it's not like turning on or turning off a switch. And so I actually think what we're seeing is that people are having a harder and harder time performing the complex multivariate analysis that's necessary to be able to be judicious about big decisions.
Yeah.
And it's happening at a time where these systems are compromising us. So it's actually not vitriol we're dealing with. You know, you ask a teenager whether Trump was a good president or bad president. You only get he was the best president of all time or the worst president of all time. And a lot of people are attributing that to like polarization of our vitriol, vernacular. I actually don't think that's what's going on. I actually think that the complexities of performing a multivariate analysis of big concepts is a thing we don't teach kids or ourselves how to do anymore.
Yeah.
And so they have to operate in binaries because that nuance has become super difficult for them to synthesize. You ask the same question of somebody in the 70s, whether Richard Nixon was a good president or a bad president. Democrats are going to say, well, I love that he opened up China. Not super big fan of his tax policy. And he's a crook, so he got what he deserved. Republican, but it's complicated. It's nuanced.
Right. It's thoughtful.
Yeah.
You ask more moderate.
Moderate. And it's and the Republican says something kind of like, I hate the China policy. I love the tax policy. And I don't think he's a criminal, but whatever. Let's uphold the sanctity of the office. The Overton window of acceptable discourse between those two people is wide open. And they used to embrace on that across every level of these relationship boundaries. In your neighborhood, they talk about it. Church, they talk about it. In families, they talk about it. And it was acceptable for people to advance their own position based off of these complex rhetorical engagements. All that's done. Totally done.
It's a lot to take in, Charlie. It's a lot to take in.
It's terrifying.
I'm picking up what you're putting down, though. So what's the role of accountable AI? What is accountable AI? You talk about this. And yeah, what's the role of it in all of this?
So we spent a lot of time in the lab thinking about this. And from examples of our own backlog that demand us paying attention to the problem. And not only is it the ethical thing to do, but I'll give you an example of when it was a challenge. We worked with a company that was identifying the right way to optimize public transportation in an American city. And their solution to that was to create a survey for people's mobile phones where they could say, hey, I wish a bus stop was here, or I wish this bus ran faster to get me on work. Great idea, right? Get everybody to weigh in and optimize public transportation. They only built that for iOS. So everybody with an Android device had no way of updating any of the preferences that they had. Immediately disenfranchising a pretty sizable chunk of the proletariat who was using the public transportation to get to and from places. And so we looked at that and we said, this is pretty untenable. If we're going to do things to support, you know, the population writ large, we need to be able to make sure that the downstream implications of these algorithms are really thoughtful. And we worked with the folks who developed that app and we said, hey guys, we need to kind of revisit all of this. This is actually exacerbating some of these problems. So accountable AI is extremely important, not only because you have to maintain a values-based operation when you're dealing with things as powerful, as potentially dangerous as artificial intelligence, but I also would contend that it's a powerful advocate for profitability. I'm a big believer that open, free markets that are largely deregulated are the most powerful mechanism for wealth traversal for the American population, and also when put into a fully transparent ecosystem, can self-regulate pretty effectively. So I think that the more open we make some of these models, some of the implications of these models, and allow the market to be truly creative and explore different ways in which these models can be deployed, that actually sets us up to be not only very successful, but generates the most American component of our whole culture, which is class traversal. It is amazing that 64% of Americans who are millionaires this generation weren't last generation or won't be the following generation. That class traversal is completely dependent on the inherent morality of free market capitalism, which is not a very popular viewpoint, probably not, well, in Austin, not so, maybe some bit more in Capital Factory. But accountable AI, when the market is aware of what's going on, can be held in check really, really, really well.
Yeah, it's a checks and balances type system for AI, similar to how we had one for the government. It sounds good. It also sounds like a lot of people and institutions need to collaborate and work together for that to really work. How do we put the rubber to the road?
Yeah, I think one of the problems is the interoperability of data systems. For a long time, folks at the lab have commented on how we have standards for things like USB drivers that Apple and Sony can sit in the same room and discuss what a USB should look like, and IEEE can put out these standards. But we don't have a consensus around how you define a human being. I'm not getting into some metaphysical argument. I'm talking about the actual way in which that's encoded within a digital system. Because if we have the ability to say this chunk of a JSON describes a human and that can be reflected across all these systems, it opens up the opportunity to partner and grow more inferences and corollaries that are valuable, but also creates a degree of authentication and safety that's valuable.
The standard needed.
Yeah. It's what's very odd is that, and very few people are talking about, but the juxtaposition between safety and privacy is for the first time in technological history at odds. Like, we kind of have to choose one, because there is privacy. The more we diminish privacy in favor of democratizing safe components, that's actually the best medium, given the fact that these database technologies are becoming more and more interoperable.
Sure. So I have one more question. We'll open it up to the audience. If anyone wants to ask Charlie a question, that'd be fantastic. So I talked about accountable AI, but also from what I read, in lieu of generative AI, you focus on deductive and contextual AI. It's another type of AI that's new to me, probably to some of our listeners. So why is this form better than the approach of generative AI?
I think that when the multimodal transformers paper came out, immediately everybody went to, let's create synthetic content. And I actually think that while there's a bit of novelty to that, and there are certainly workflows and industries that are going to be wildly disrupted by that, the generation of content is actually what we should be empowering humans to do, as opposed to creating synthetic systems to do exactly that. And what I mean by that is, at our core, this spark of humanity is really around the ability to synthesize information and creatively ascertain a thesis that's viable, and then put that thesis forward and corroborate that with other material, right? Across every medium, whether it's art, writing, it doesn't matter. And so when we try to offload that to a synthetic system that's not really optimized for that, we start running into major issues. We see issues all over the place. Just read any headline from Gemini over the last couple of months, and they will show you why this is an issue. So we looked at that and we said, well, all these tools are designed to help people write and create art at scale, we should use the same tool to help people read and consume information at scale. Let's reverse the directionality of that. And let's put a human being, an analyst, in a position where if they have to make a really complicated decision and they have to review 10,000 documents to get that done, how do we make that tenable? And that's ostensibly what Andromeda does across various industries.
Yeah.
So it's not a pitch for Andromeda, but we're so obsessed with this particular problem that that's what we've dedicated. We've literally bet the farm on that operation.
As a podcaster, I've been contemplating how I use generative AI and AI, and you just helped me put some things together in my head. There's just kind of the two approaches. One, the wild one, is the like a synthetic voice, and I can upload my podcast files to software right now, and it can create a synthetic Nick voice. I can go off into the hills, and y'all can listen to my synthetic voice. Or what I am actually doing is, when I prepare for the episode, when I prepared for this, I took the Andromeda press release, I took a couple other articles and put it into ChatGPT, and I've got notes and I was able to access it. And now that's the stuff I've been reading. This is where it comes from. That sounds more of like what you're going after. Yeah, that one. So not saying I'm not ever going to do a synthetic voice, but
it's practical.
I agree.
Yeah, it's practical too. I mean, so a lot of people got excited because a couple of songs came out recently that were AI generated. I challenge, next time somebody brings this up, ask them, how many times have you listened to that song? Like, actually listen.
Right.
It's not like some Taylor Swift knockout, slam dunk hit, or Kendrick Lamar. Oh, wait, he's fighting with Drake. I don't know. Somebody's fighting with somebody, and I'm not picking sides. It doesn't matter. My point is that nobody's actually consuming all of that content and getting excited about it. Right. Nobody's looking at a DALL-E output and saying, hey, I need to spend $5,000 to frame it and put it on my wall. Or if you do, I should sell you a project because you're not making great.
Yeah, this stuff's music, content, art, it's about emotions, right? And the power of it is that you can speak to these emotions through song, poetry, whatever, because we can't talk about these emotions in one-on-one. It's just too hard. And this is all based on language, but we can't, we haven't put it out there, right? And it takes that human intuition to really speak and create the content that, is the Taylor Swift hit or whatever it may be. So.
If you believe that intelligence is nothing more than patterns of patterns, then we're in very good shape to have generative AI create content, media, art that we're going to be excited about.
Right. Just like if you're a VC and you think the next unicorn will look like the last unicorn, then I think you're wrong. So, well, it's a lot, Charlie. I got to cede my questioning here till I process some of this. But anyone in the audience have a question or two you could ask Charlie?
Hey, my name's Michael House, Symbii AI. I am not an AI person. I'm a software developer. You said that you guys are working on things to predict how misinformation, radicalization, and maybe in a general sense, ideology spreads to an area and how that influences people and how those influences propagate. Given that we're living in a sort of a toxic, antagonistic media environment that just, you know, it got that way because it was crowdsourced. There's no antagonist back there. If you have the capability to extract that sort of information, you know, to see how behavior modifies and how it propagates, working backwards, don't you have the ability to increase the toxification, increase radicalization, increase polarization, and sort of lead people without their knowledge towards ends that you want as a population?
So if we've entered the information age, every age is punctuated by a new form of weaponry. The atomic age led to atomic weapons. You can go all the way back to the Bronze Age to exemplify how this is the case. There's no doubt that the ability to synthesize how an ideology has shifted across a region yields a mechanism for weaponization of that same capability. Now, at the lab, we're pretty committed to make sure that when that gets weaponized, it's done in our hands on behalf of our partners within the DoD, because there's no group I trust more than good, solid Americans to have that responsibility, especially when that responsibility is a prerequisite for undermining the capabilities that are generated by our peers and near peers. Make no mistake about it, the Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, and the Russians are extremely interested in how to do precisely this. And so undermining their ability is of utmost importance. So you're not wrong that weaponization is important. But I'll also call out that there are very seismic changes that nobody is really discussing too much around how mass media is changing aggressively. And one of the things that I actually find is a silver lining in this whole discussion is that some of the media types that are being consumed now are actually less vitriolic or much more about opening an Overton window than traditionally have been the case. For example, Rachel Maddow, Sean Hannity, probably the two exemplifications of the most radicalized traditional corporate media content generators on the planet, their viewership is less than 4% of what Joe Rogan has on his own. I'm not saying Joe Rogan is the standard we should all work towards, but you can say a lot of things about Joe Rogan. He is certainly up for open conversation. Some of the things that come out of that you may not agree with, but he's open for conversation. You say the same thing for the Pod Save America guys. You could say the same thing about a lot of podcasts across multiple parts of the spectrum where they're actually optimizing for rhetoric, not in spite of rhetoric, for rhetoric, not an avoidance of rhetoric. And so I actually think the market is starting to say, we're not interested in this anymore. Fox News is down 45% over the last quarter for their viewership. MSNBC has been on a decline over the last year and a half. And CNN viewership, I mean, you guys probably saw the highlight from the Colbert show where he made a light joke about, he didn't even intend to make a joke about whether or not it was a trusted news source being CNN, the whole audience laughed at him. So it's quite a snippet. And so I actually think that the market is just exhausted from all of this and that the embracing long-form podcasts, long-form discussions, people are hungry for that. And so I inherently have optimism that I think that the return of Friedman-style conversations, if you're somebody who is adherent on the right, a Chomsky-style conversations, if you're adherent to somebody on the left, Rogan, if you're somewhere that it's not really clear where, like
all of the,
or Friedman. I mean, these are all exemplifications of long form podcasts where the rhetoric window is wide open. And that's super encouraging to me. So I hope those two parts answered your question.
Well, what I'm thinking of is that in a free market environment, you have someone like Facebook, okay, as an example. They are incentivized to increase engagement by whatever means necessary. Given that if the tools are out there, and they won't say the province of governments, they won't say superpower tools, they'll be open sourced, leaked, recreated somehow. And those tools exist. By the tools, I mean the reverse of predicting behavior, modifying behavior on a mass scale. It's in their best interest to use those tools to modify the behavior of anyone that comes into contact with them to do what they want them to do, which is be on the platform more often, to proselytize the platform, to try to bring more profits in for Facebook. So there may be a shift towards a more long-form discussion, a more reasoned discussion, and more cross-aisle interaction. But there are companies that are incentivized to, as much as they can, manipulate the audience to bring in a profit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's something you have a view on. I don't really have a question with that. It was just a continuation.
It's an observation for sure that I think it resonates. I don't think Meta is going to be relevant in a generation or two. They're really struggling.
It might be a bad example.
What's that?
I said it might be a bad example.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, but there are examples that are great too. I totally agree with your point. TikTok right now has an incredible amount of adoption and is very intentionally, we can demonstrably prove this is an advocate and an ally of the Chinese government. That is very conclusive at this point. If you have a problem with what happened on October 7th, and then you really, really should, or else we should have a conversation afterwards that I can explain why you're wrong. October 7th was very, very much exacerbated as an event because of TikTok, with the Chinese acting as a proxy to undermine Western values. That's a problem to me. That should be a problem for everybody. And so obviously Israel's in my command as part of the command that I serve within. I am unafraid to be very resolute and direct about the fact that we need to recognize that is the forefront of the West's attack by the neo-Marxists coming out of China, unequivocally. TikTok has been a major advocate of the undermining of our relationship with Israel, and it's now become stateside. The very tight relationships with all the protests that we saw in Colombia, all of these events that spark this cognitive dissonance about why people who would be oppressed in Gaza are advocating on behalf of a terrorist organization. That has all been exacerbated by a platform intentionally designed to undermine Western values and West alliances.
I appreciate you taking the question, and I will stop hogging the mic.
No worries. That was great questions. Thank you.
So my question pertains to the data science of recommend intent and some of these algorithms and how they're being deployed societally. So when you were talking about content being generated overtly, these outlets and the differences between these influencers or a Joe Rogan, like a mega influencer versus traditional media, that's the part that's like visible to society and is overt. But the underlying data science about taking all of these micro influencers and then targeting you with a constellation of content that's under the surface, it's implicit to these media distribution infrastructures. How do we address that and approach that? Because it's so difficult to have a countervailing AI that can do that when you could have millions of countervailing algorithms that are doing this. And then you have the state-driven ones, which is exactly what your point was with respect to TikTok. And I completely agree with that sentiment. If we look back to Cambridge Analytica, for instance, we can see the power of being able to change the global landscape with data science and deploying that. And you can't catch up when people realize who were behind that those initiatives, the damage was well underway and practically done.
There's a lot of different ways to dig into that. You know, these aren't really targeted ads, they're more targeted campaigns that we're dealing with. And that coordination is difficult to mitigate. It's also the case that until we embrace a model where people crave authenticated content and the articulation of that, it's going to be very, very hard to get something that's adopted en masse. I think we're going to see that. I do. I think that the adoption of capabilities that are forced to articulate their relationships are growing. I think DuckDuckGo is a great team working on this exact problem. And anybody, if you had told me 5 years ago that they would be actually giving a real shot against search engines, it's not a giant shot, but a decent shot, I'd have been flabbergasted. I thought for sure the Alphabet guys would have had that locked up. But Alphabet also is making gestures that show that they actually don't believe that these campaigns are as effective as they thought they were once. They're making investments into entities that are very, very displaced out of ad tech, because I actually think that fundamentally, people are more aware of campaigns than we give them credit for. And either it reiterates something they already believe, or it's something that they ignore because they disagree with it. And I actually think that the psyche writ large is more immutable than I think some of those developers give it credit for. But it's going to require competition in the market, and also a need, the market coming out and saying, we need to have solutions that call out where these biases exist, how this is part of a larger campaign. I own my own data, and I want to make sure that anybody who's accessing it and utilizing it across cookies, whatever the new paradigm that's about to be released, I want to ensure that I'm tracking all of those manifestations. I think people are getting closer to that. We're not there today. And I think that we can actually mitigate a lot of those risks in the interim.
Speaking of search as a paradigm shift, what are your impressions of how the landscape is going to shift when you have products like SearchGPT and other answer engines changing how SEO is relevant or irrelevant and how people are discovering information? Because again, this goes back to these hidden algorithms, being able to determine systematically what information is deemed relevant for you and then how that's indexed and scraped and deep scraped and incorporated into these training passes. That dictates what people ultimately down the road find as the answers to their questions. But that's very much under the control of a small group of key players with the horsepower to do these training runs.
Yeah, I'm no futurist. I usually despise people who make that that claim. My hope is that we have this monopolist, really duopoly that exists right now that's really, really hard for people to appreciate usually. Amazon and Google basically own this entire space right now. What happens when there's not really one search engine and one provider for 40% of the underlying architecture of the network? What happens when there's like 50 different search engines that you can choose from? There's a very good chance that the proliferation of advertisements that make those search engines viable, A, that model's going to evolve, and there's going to be a lot of competition in that market. And I actually think by the time that happens, people are going to be so cognizant of these issues that they're going to say, hey, I would like to work with an ad provider that isn't trying to undermine my own psyche, right? That is looking for an earnest way to be able to put a product in front of me that I'm interested in without contriving my actual behavior. That sounds far-fetched that people are going to ask that, but I actually see it now. My five-year-old just started kindergarten. We toured a lot of schools. Guess how many of the, probably 9 or 10 schools we looked at. Guess how many of those schools allowed devices on campus? Zero. Zero. Not a single one. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, people would be proliferating, hey, we have iPads for every kindergartner. That'd been a selling point.
They don't even have the iPads like in class.
No,
like
the entire classroom, especially the one that we selected, no devices go into the building. And it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. And that actually gives me hope back to our multivariate analysis conversation. Yeah. Maybe this will do it. Right. Let's get it back on track.
Yeah.
So I think that's like things like that are promising that the market will demand that. And I also think that this giant ripple that's being created by these by the search democratization can have a big impact on that as well.
Yep. And I would be remiss to know we are in the University of Austin office here at Capital Factory, a new university launching with a lot of the same vigor. Maybe one more question. We're bumping up on time. If y'all need to sneak out, we got one more here, and then we'll wrap up. If you need to sneak out, that's totally fine. But yeah, this has been great.
Hi, Jose, founder of CEO BradQuery.ai. We use AI systems. We've deployed AI systems, generally speaking, for retrieving facts and summarizing information, right, along the lines of what was discussed earlier. I'm very interested in your opinion on the ability, current or future, of AI systems to actually reason. If you look at how LLMs are built, as we all know, right, it's a probabilistic system based on what was written in the past. On the one hand, or on the other hand, try to find a correct fact to answer this question using some kind of RAG system. But to what degree can they actually innovate / reason / uncover things, insights that we humans would have been incapable of achieving ourselves? What's your thought on that?
The first time I developed machine learning model professionally was almost 20 years ago, 19 years ago, at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. At the time, I was convinced that AGI, and the ability for computers to synthetically reason, to innovate, to push creativity autonomously, would happen within my lifetime. In the 19 or so years that have come since, I am now more resolute than ever that it won't even happen in my grandchildren's lifetime. And I'm absolutely positive it won't be a silicon-based capability that does that. If we are to create a technology that can create a synthetic intelligence, I'm quite convinced that the only mechanism to do that will be identified within biological sciences. That the underlying mechanics of how we store information is still so elusive to us. Way in which patterns are recognized. Neuroscientists are doing their best, but they are really at a disadvantage with the technology that we have at our disposal. Just observe that. I doubt very, very much that silicon-based synthetic computers will get to the point where they're able to quote-unquote reason. I think what's much more likely, if I were to fast forward to the moment where they have a reasoning machine, it's going to look like a greenhouse that's been heavily instrumented and capabilities across the greenhouse are pooled together as a collection of shared resources. And it sounds silly, but there is magic in the way we manipulate proteins in our noggin, and not just us, invertebrates, take a look at cephalopods. Incredible the way those creatures operate with very, very complex electromagnetic networks on top of complex protein structures. There is no way that those guys are operating on 12 milliwatts and doing things that we have supercomputer craze up at Pickle that can't do that. There's no way that we've got the paradigm right. We've got the paradigm wrong, and we need research where we can observe neurons in action in real time to be able to get to the point where we can create that. A good analogy that I was told a couple of years ago was that if a neuron is a corn stalk, we have about as much fidelity as you would have at 30,000 feet flying over that cornfield. So you have a view of a farm and hear some irrigation patterns and, hey, a forest fire, also known as a stroke, we can indicate those things. But in terms of, if we need to create a full synthetic intelligence, I need to know how many corn modules there are on that corn stalk. We need to be on the ground, opening it up, playing with it, watching how the farm operates over the course of a whole season, right? We're way, 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 way away from that, just the observation of those mechanics. So I think those who are fear-mongering around the capabilities of an AGI to create real problems for our civilization are probably looking for a pause so that they can get an advantage on cloud compute. Not to be a cynic, but I'm a pretty good evidence that's exactly what they're doing. Anybody who is a real bona fide scientist in this space dispels pretty quickly the tenability of a reasoning machine. We just have really gimmicky magic tricks that we're doing right now that are making us think we're getting closer.
Well, I really wish I didn't have to shut this down. This is fascinating. I sense a follow-on episode in the future as this all plays out right in front of us. But we have a few more sessions left at FET Supernova. We're going to move it forward. Everyone, please join me in thanking Charlie for coming on the show. Thanks for listening to this episode of Austinpreneur. Don't forget to check out capitalfactory.com to learn more about us and join our community. If you have thoughts about the show or ideas on how we can work together, reach out to me directly via email, nickspiller@capitalfactory.com. Shout out to the Capital Factory Dream Team for making this podcast possible, and special thanks to Aaron Handworker, who masterfully recorded and edited the show. Come back next week for a whole new episode.